From GEICO Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts. Tonight, you just left for work and had a non-specific feeling that something was happening to your place and it wasn't good. Dan?
Exactly, Tammy. It could be smoke damage, theft, or just too much caffeine, but you can't stop thinking about it.
But with renter's insurance through GEICO, your stuff is covered, so you don't have to worry.
And that's great, because the weekend is coming up and it's chock full of social obligations that are ready to fill that void.
Oh boy, will they, Dan? It feels good to worry less. It feels good to GEICO.
The Last Word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.
Marie Gleason, you're very welcome to The Last Word. Thank you for coming in to tell us about your book, Be Like the Sea, your memoir. And you've got a remarkable story because it's not just being an Irish Navy captain. This is an unusual story in that you came from a farming background, but it's also talks about very personal loss in relation to a child born after being diagnosed with fatal fetal abnormality. And can I actually start with that maybe, please? Because, you know, we heard an awful lot about women who were living through that back at the time of the abortion referendum, nearly a decade ago now at this stage. And you learnt at how many weeks?
Just nearly 24 weeks, yeah.
Okay.
So we're just 6 months pregnant, just gone 6 months pregnant, yeah. Yeah.
And you continued with the pregnancy and your son lived.
You're on, yeah.
For
yeah.
How many days?
Six days. Yeah.
How important was it for you that you had those 6 days?
Yeah, huge. So we were 4 weeks pregnant the day we got married. Very unexpected because I had been told I would have huge struggles with fertility. I have polycystic ovarian syndrome. So we kind of threw caution to the wind, thinking it would take us years and there'd have to be intervention. So actually at the start, it was like this amazing miracle. And you know, the day you get married and the priest says like the children you may, and there's this little moment and you're like, oh, and like this massive secret. So, yeah, so it was brilliant.
So you knew at that stage?
We knew that we were 4 weeks pregnant. Nobody else did. Yeah, yeah, yeah. My granny definitely didn't. So, immaculate conception. So, so then like, you know, like young, naive parents, we went through and Professor Keelan O'Donoghue was our consultant in CMH and we were in with her for the anomaly scan. And then she said, oh, there's something. I just want you to come back in a couple of weeks. And Keelan is phenomenal. If anybody like Keelan is a brilliant medical professional. So she didn't say what it was. So when she brought us in, we were still quite naive and we found out the gender that day. So we went from this elation of having this little baby boy to finding out that that little baby boy had a very complicated congenital heart defect. And the day we were in the coom then a week later with the paediatric team up there, like that was just a really, really tough day because we had gone to Dublin thinking of other people we knew whose babies had had, you know, holes in the heart or some kind of a heart defect and had been in Crumlin and had surgery. So I suppose that's where we were at. And then when the consultant drew out the diagram of Kieran's heart versus another baby's heart, there were so many different complexities that because there were so many, it meant that his heart was very badly functional, wasn't going to work. So when John said to the paediatric cardiologist, what are the options? When they said, first off, you know, we recommend you go to the UK for termination, like that just took the wind out of our sails because we were not, wasn't even in consideration. And I think, like I said this in the book, like we drive back to the Killeshea House Hotel and like I'm a talker, my husband isn't. So there was silence in the car. Like, and when we got back to Killeshea and we sat down, like I think neither one of us really wanted to speak because we didn't want to influence the other person. But we knew we didn't make this terrible decision. And like, I think maternally I was in a heap. Like I was, I don't even think I was functioning at that stage, but the military side of my, like, I mean, I'm trained to make decisions. That's my core skill set, like, and high risk, high intensity decisions. And we have a system for that. So I think that side of my
brain. Does that take emotion out of your decision making?
It doesn't take it out, but you definitely control it. So an awful lot of military decision making is about, you know, controlling your breathing, making sure that you're in a good headspace so that you can see what the various options are. You can analyze all of those. You work with your team, but ultimately the decision will come to you as a commanding officer. Like that's why you get paid and that's why you're in charge. So I do think that skill set meant that we could analyse what was there. And for us at that moment in time where we were at, like we didn't have other kids, we were in a good place in our relationship, you know. So I think for us in that moment, that was the right decision. You know, I'm not saying I would make the same decision in a different circumstance. And I think that's why, talking about the referendum, I was very clear at the time when I was asked my opinion that really nobody knows until they're in the circumstance, because, you know, in a different circumstance, we might have made a different decision. But we then, you know, the way I went about it then was to try and continue as normal as possible. So we didn't really tell that many people. And I went back to work, and I was working for the then Commodore Mark Mellett, and the medical doctor in the naval base would only let me go back to work if I didn't work for him, because the two of us as a combination were workaholics. So he was like, I will let you go back to work on a 3-day week, but you cannot work for him. And even that reflects where I was at in my life at that stage. And I did, threw myself back into work, and, you know, Ciarán did so well. Like, everything they were telling us, he was countering it. Like, he grew, he was 8'14" when he was born. Like, he was gorgeous. He was beautiful, beautiful baby. And they had asked us to sign a DNR in the coom, and we didn't, we wouldn't. And that caused a bit of tension with the medical team.
Sorry, just to explain to people.
Oh, yeah.
DNR is do not resuscitate.
Yeah, yeah. So they had asked us to sign it, and we wouldn't. And then the day he was born by emergency section, and Professor Sean Daly, I remember him taking him out, and he roared the place down. And like, that was just, I was like, I've never more beautiful sound in your life, because this baby was there and he was fighting. And then he was in the ambulance with John going up to Crumlin within 3 hours. And like, they had told us he'd never get to Crumlin. We didn't even go to Crumlin to see the ICU or anything, because they told us he'd never get there. So like,
and how soon were you able to get there?
Yeah, so I had to stay. I remember I had to stay in the coom for the, I could have sent him, but 24 hours, because I was post-section. But then John got this 24 hours with Ciarán that was just him and Ciarán. Whereas like, I had had him to a certain extent, I had him with me, whereas John hadn't. So I think that even in itself gave me a bit of comfort, because I was like, he's with his dad and he's getting time with his dad. But the first few days, like, Ciarán did really well considering where he was at. And like, the naval chaplain, Father Dez, came in and baptised him. And my grandparents and the godparents were there, our aunts and uncles. My brother-in-law, Owen, is a rugby player. And Owen actually used to refer to him as a rugby player, because he looked like a rugby player compared to all the other tiny little babies. And yet he was the sickest of all of them. But like, everyone has different beliefs and, you know.
Did you have hope that stage that he was going to beat all the odds?
Yeah, huge. That's what kept me going. I think I was very focused on the fact that he was doing so well. Like, the medical team kept telling us, there's nothing different. We just don't understand how his heart is working the way it is. But I think for me, that kind of fight and resolve, and he was doing so, like, I was maternally hugely proud of this tiny little baby. Like, it that doesn't make a lot of sense, but in the moment, this was huge. And yeah, and then he was slowly starting to deteriorate. You could see that. And then my granny passed away on the Friday. So my granny passed away on Friday the 13th of January, but she had, her kidneys had failed before Christmas. She shouldn't have been still with us. And when she went, I think I nearly got this boost, because that sounds terrible, because your granny's just died. But I felt like she had waited to take his place. So she was, you know. But then unfortunately that evening he crashed on his way to surgery, and then he was a very, very sick baby. And we had a very challenging weekend in Crumlin with a phenomenal team. Like, you know, I talk a lot in the book about what it's like to be at sea and to be a captain of a ship and be involved in all these big search and rescues and drug missions and what we do. But actually, when you're in a paediatric ICU and you see the intensity of what the medical team are working with, like these tiny babies, the microdosing, the stress and the decision making that they're carrying. And they were so good to us, like, because our families weren't there. Mine were down at the removal, and John's got a bug and couldn't come in because they have to be so careful of any kind of illness or infection. And like, I would not wish on my worst enemy, you know, those last couple of hours with Ciarán, because whilst it was in some ways great that we got that, because my biggest fear was that he would be born, stillborn, and we wouldn't get any time with him. But, you know, it's not something any parent should ever have to do, is hold their baby in their arms. Like, it's just not, it's not right in any shape or form. But again, I have his eternity ring on my finger. That's why I'm looking at it there. But my granny, for me, waited for Ciarán. So like, what kept me going then was that he was going to somebody who was going to mind him. And I think that was a huge piece for me. And I think the whole navigation of storms and grief and life. Like, I come from a dairy farm. I knew nothing about the sea. And then I end up on a ship at sea and I'm learning to navigate and I'm learning what you do when you come off course and how do you survive a storm. And sometimes it's literally put the nose of the ship into the waves and slow down and just ride that storm. And I think those kind of lessons really helped me. And I leaned in a lot to that kind of mindset of, you know, even if I don't want to get up, even if we can't think about surviving, we will survive. Like, the RNLI do this amazing campaign called Float to Live. And I remember at the time, our sea survival training was always, don't fight it, you know, just float and you will survive. And for a lot of that time afterwards, I think that's what we were doing. And we had this amazing support network. And again, like, we hear so much in the world now about people, and because a lot of it can be negative, but like, God, when we were in that situation, people came from everywhere, like the Navy, John's colleagues, my family, our friends, like, it was huge. But yeah, it's not a space you want to be in on maternity leave with no baby. But I think the piece of something like that, it changes your perspective on the world. And I think that old me, who was the workaholic, who was go, 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 I think everybody in the Navy expected that I would be back at work ASAP, that I would throw myself into the job. And even I was shocked when I didn't want to do that. So I think, like, the reason I wrote the book and the reason I've spoken out about this is because back then, like, what I needed was visibility of survivors. I needed to see people who had got through the storm. And in 2012, like, it wasn't as visible or as easy to see stories like that. And I think for me, that kind of your mind's not mind, like, I don't want to use words that sound like it's part of the narrative now, but like being able to look at the worst possible situation and look for something that was good in it. So, like, you know, having that time with Kieran, he made me a mammy, you know, I wanted to make him proud. So there were all these things. So the days that were bad were really bad, and there was nothing good in those days. But the days when I could take something good out of the story, that was the life raft.
And I think the book will be something for the children you've had subsequently, yeah, when they're old enough to read it and understand that this will help them understand. Tell us about them now. Yeah. What age are they?
So writing the book, so Leisha, it will be 11 next week, and Murrin is 9 and a half, and that half is very important. And they are fantastic girls, and we had a battle to have them, which is a whole other chapter in the book. Like, life was not exactly kind to us in that regard afterwards. But fighting to have them was like fighting to save their brother, but we got a great outcome there. Even though we had a lot of sadness and hurt, we ended up with these two fabulous girls. And since I left the Navy 7 years ago and I ended up in this totally, you know, mad place of speaking on stages about leadership and working with companies and teams. But actually, the girls saw me speak last year for the first time at a fundraiser in Kinsale for the Pregnancy Loss Research Group in Cork. And we brought them down to meet the likes of Keelan, who'd last seen them when they were babies. And about 3 weeks later, Leisha was on the couch at home. She's a big reader and she loves historical stuff like Lily at Lisadell. And she was like, "Mammy, will you do something for me? Will you write a book about a girl from a farm who goes to sea?" And I had been rolling the concept of a book in my head, and I had been thinking about it, and I was thinking of sharing the story and the power of sharing your story and the impact it has for other people. But everyone has a little bit of imposter syndrome in them. And when you're from the country, there's also the notions, like, who writes a book about themselves? A woman with notions. So there was that bit, even though I knew I had a story, I knew I was having a powerful impact for people, there was still a bit of, and then the day she said that to me, I was like, no. Yeah, that's
because
how she
there's an enormous amount in the story, and we're not going to have time to talk about it all in the interview, but that's probably a good thing because that'll send people to the book anyway. But you didn't grow up with this idea of going to sea, did you?
No, I come from a farm.
This just happened almost by chance.
And that's another kind of key tenet for me about the book. So you said there about writing it for the girls. And there is an element of, I do a lot of work in schools at the moment with 16, 17, 18 year olds, a lot of young women.
Doing what?
I go in and I work with them around life skills like communication, leadership, decision making, you know, just, I suppose, the power, again, someone coming in to tell the story, especially a woman who went into an atypical job and made
went into a man's
world.
Yeah. Come on, let's call a spade here. You went into a very male dominated profession, and it must have been very, and it is, as you point out at times, very difficult even for somebody like even you who can talk to get a word in edgeways at times.
I didn't talk like this back in the Navy. I used a lot less words. Yeah, but I think that piece of like the Navy was not the right job for me. No career guidance teacher would have recommended the Navy to a girl from a farm in Tipperary in 1996 when I did my leaving cert. Like the Navy had only just taken women in 95. So going into the Navy, like you can end up in a job that's totally not the right fit for you. You could be, you know, you can, your leaving cert can go wrong, all these different things in your life. You're, you know, you can face all these different challenges and storms. But for the young women that I meet, for the people, for anybody, you know, you can survive the storms once you've, you can work on how you look at it, and then you've got the support networks around you. And I think that's why for me, this book is important for everybody, but for young women particularly. And I have written it with the girls in mind, in that instance of, if I'm not around when they're facing a challenge in the future, they pick up the book and it doesn't matter what it is. And yeah, you can go into the Navy and you can be totally, you know, like I look back at me when I joined first and I think, oh my God, because I was so enthusiastic. I was so driven. I was so loud. I was nothing grey. And they say to survive in cadetships in the military, you should be somewhere in the middle. But actually they learned about me and I learned about them. And some of it was me moderating my behaviours because of the impact on other people. And some of it was for them to open up and say, well, actually, you know, women can do it and you're just as good as the lads.
Do you miss the excitement of things like major drug busts and things like that? Chasing down criminals on the high seas. Yeah. Do you not miss it?
Yeah, the one, like everyone says to me after 7 years, God, you really loved your job. And I did. And it was really hard to leave. But I really miss being at sea. Like I
Why, what is it about being at sea?
Yeah. And I had never been to sea. I had never even been on a boat or a sailboat or a ferry even to France. I'd never been at sea. But
so you had no experience of seasickness?
No, nothing. And I don't get seasick, which is amazing. That's like such a blessing. But then the resilience of people who do, the people who do 30 years in the Navy and still know that for the first 3 days they're going to be sick. Like really sick, and they still do it. That's admirable. Like that's
why? Why would you do that?
Do you know the way when you talk about purpose, like in companies and stuff, they're like, oh, purpose, mission statement, values. Like that's all military terminology. Like you're talking about that drug mission. Like when you're involved in a mission where your purpose is to take narcotics, illegal narcotics off the streets of Ireland. And when you're on the high seas, 175 miles southwest of Kerry, the middle of the night, the dark, the intensity, really tough weather conditions, and you're all prepping to go out into that world, like that's purpose. Everybody's aligned. Everyone knows what the mission is. And like when the two boats go away from the ship with the boarding team, that's a third of the crew gone. So that means two thirds have got to step up and they've got to do 100%, and they've got to man all the weapons and they've got to be operating at the top. So in that instance, there's no man, there's no woman. You know, you're looking at the team and can the team do it? You know, and you've cooks firing weapons and you've engineers trying to make sandwiches. We won't talk about that, but they did feed us eventually. But like, you know, the moments in that mission when, you know, the boats were deployed and we were waiting for the signal from them, like you're in the dark, you're gone silent, you know, everything is shut down and you're just waiting on one code word and everybody is waiting. Like that intensity is hard to replicate in a normal 9-to-5 job. So yeah, you'd absolutely miss that.
Your daughters have a great story to read, and before they get to it, lots of other people will do it. Be like the sea, Marie Gleeson. Thank you so much for being with us on The Last Word here in Today FM.
Thank you, Matt.
The Last Word
with Life Pharmacy. Over 100 local pharmacies nationwide that are always here to help. Life Pharmacy. Live better together.